This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
838-3006 and ask for tickets to the People's Agenda. I'll see you there.
Hi, it's Tuesday at midnight. This is WBAI New York. My name is Anne Marie Hendrickson, and you're listening to the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade.
Gee, the moon is shining bright. I can't wait to hold you tight. Gee, the moon is shining bright. I can't wait to hold you tight. Baby, come on. Baby, don't make me wait. Summer is here now, so let's stay out late. Oh, gee, the moon is shining bright. I can't wait to hold you tight. The summertime is made for love. The summertime is made for love. I wanna kiss you.
A song that I'm playing from the pen of the great New York songwriter Ellie Greenwich, who died here in New York on August 26th. And that's the Dixie Cups. Gee, the moon is shining bright. And I'm going to spend some time playing some of her music and then talk about why I played it. The next song I'm going to play is far and away my favorite of all her songs, and this is the Ronettes. And if it's lined up correctly, then it is going to be, in fact, the song I had in mind.
Easy. grandma was sitting by the fire. My grandma told your grandma, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. You're talking about hey now, hey now, hey now. Aiko, aiko, ande. Giacomo Fino, anane. Giacomo Finane. Look at my king all dressed in red. Aiko, aiko, ande. I bet you $5 he'll kill you dead. Giacomo Finane. Talking about hey now. My flag boy and your flag boy sitting by the fire. My flag boy to your flag boy, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. Talking about here now, here now, here now. I go one day. Shagamo fino, I'm nani. Shagamo finani. See that guy all dressed in green, Aiko Aiko Ande. He's not a man, he's a loving machine. Giacomo Finane. Talking about him now, him now, him now, him now. Aiko Aiko Ande. Giacomo Fino Anane. Giacomo Finane. Talking about him now, him now, him now. Aiko Aiko Ande. Girls can tell. Girls can tell. Girls can tell if things are right when they kiss a boy goodnight. And I can tell that you're just right for me. Girls can tell if boys are true by the little things they do. And I can tell that you'll be true to me.
Trust in him.
I know that he'll be true. I love my baby. He's so good. Yeah. And I will love him all my life. That's understood. And I tell him, G, baby, G.
Jimmy's ring you're wearing?
Mm-hmm.
Gee, it must be great riding with him. Is he picking you up after school today? right, where'd you meet him?
The tears were beginning to show. As he drove away on that rainy night, I begged him to go slow. Whether he heard, I'll never know.
The Shangri-Las, the leader of the pack, of course. And that whole last half hour of music was a lot of very well-known songs, all written by the great New York songwriter Ellie Greenwich, who died here in the city on August 26th. And we heard in no particular order. My own favorite of her songs, which is Baby, I Love You. And we also heard Be My Baby, Why Don't They Let Us Fall in Love, which, as you probably heard, is kind of another version of Gee, the Moon is Shining Bright, which we also heard by the Dixie Cups. I Wonder, and we also heard People Say, Ico Ico, Girls Can Tell. As I said, G, the Moon is Shining Bright, G, Baby, G, and All Grown Up by the Dixie Cups. And she wrote even a great deal more than that, but that is half an hour's worth of music by Ellie Greenwich. And this genre of music is, you know, it's both very beloved on a certain level and also kind of looked down on another level, because it is, of course, very oriented toward girls and teenage girls. And the whole emotional atmosphere of exhilaration and panic that goes through all these songs is what is so charming about them, I guess, if you stand far enough away, and poignant and moving if you stand a little closer. Ellie Greenwich wrote all these songs, but mostly with her husband, Jeff Berry. She wrote other songs. She had a long career in the business, but she wrote the bulk of the things that people like myself remember her by before she was 30, and that's always kind of a difficult situation for an artist to do to do a lot of work before, you know, while they're still young, because of course you have to live the rest of your life with everyone looking back on amazing things that they have very fond feelings toward, and you still have more to say, and it may not be quite in the same genre. And I believe it's something along that line is sort of what happened to her, although she did get involved with different kinds of oldies scenes, including a musical that was kind of based on her songs and to some extent, I believe, even on her life, called Leader of the Pack in the mid-80s. And she was from Hicksville, Long Island, home of, I guess most famously, Billy Joel, but I always think of it as the home of punk rock great Michael Board, my former next-door neighbor, and the leader of the bands Art and Artless, longtime columnist in Maximum Rock and Roll, and punk rock contrarian by temperament, really a New York treasure, a punk rock treasure by anybody's standards. And so Illy Greenwich and Michael Board, I think it was the two great people that came out of Hicksville. But a sad passing for Illy Greenwich. She was sick for a long time, and they haven't really had a public memorial for it. I don't know if they're going to. I know that they had her family had some kind of private memorial for her. Wow, I had something I was going to say and it totally passed out of my mind. Another person that died recently, this isn't what I was going to move into, but someone else that died in the last couple of days, of course, is Patrick Swayze, who perhaps is, I feel like I have to mention, because he starred in one of the greatest professional wrestling movies of all time, which is Roadhouse, which was starred, one of the co-stars was Terry Funk, and Terry Funk choreographed all the fights in it. And if you had, cable at any point in the 90s, you probably saw it every weekend on TNT when it played over and over and over again. And I guess he's probably best known for Ghost, which I've never seen, and for Dirty Dancing, which is not particularly a favorite of mine, but also for his breakout role. It might have been for his, I don't think it was his first role in movies, but I think the role that kind of established him and gave him a career was playing the older brother Daryl, the beleaguered, put upon and kind of overwhelmed older brother of Soda Pop and Pony Boy Curtis in The Outsiders, which is of course for Francis Ford Coppola's movie of S.E. Hinton's classic teenage novel of the 60s made into a movie in the early 80s. And so if Patrick Swayze had never done anything other than just be in The Outsiders and been in Roadhouse, I would remember him fondly. Oh, also Point Break, the Zen Master, bank robber. But really, you know, the professional wrestling Outsiders connection is what I remember him for, and I feel like I have to say something nice about him because of that. And having led into that, the thing I had originally intended to do tonight and what I'm going to go move into now is I have been threatening for a while about talking about library work and my feelings about library work after several decades of doing it. And let's open with a song, and then I'll, which I believe is already queued up, and then I'll start talking.
Chapter 1, I met him at a bank, and we fell
Wow, what's that? Okay, that was I Could Write a Book About My Baby by the Pandoras, the original Pandoras, not the Neo Pandoras, I guess I should say. This is the 1960s Pandoras, and this is from a great record called Girls with Guitars on the Ace label from England. It's probably might be available on something else too, but I've never actually seen it on another collection. And it's such a lovely song. What to say? Oh, and I forgot to mention. Yes, this is what I was trying to. This is what I had the brain freeze about before. That Jim Carroll talking about local artists who died. People who died. Well, here we are. Thanks to whatever kind person put up that very clean video that we just played off YouTube. We don't even know where or when it's from, but it certainly sounded nice, didn't it? Oh, Jim Carroll, a local notable light for years and years and years, has, like all the people who wrote about, died. and we remember him fondly. The first time I ever saw Jim Carroll, he was standing in St. Mark's bookstore back when they had the two levels, and he was like fighting with the guy downstairs about his getting money for his consignment poetry books. Oh, it was such a moment for me as a young Californian moving to New York City, seeing actual big time poetry celebrities on the streets of New York City. It was almost as big as when I saw somebody push Johnny Thunders off a bar stool on The Holiday. But he did a lot of great stuff, and like Ellie Greenwich, you could say that like he died before he should have, but he certainly left, not everybody leaves a body of work behind that people are going to remember, and he certainly did, as she did. And my reason for bringing up Roadhouse before I kind of digressed was that one of the great lines in Roadhouse is, of course, it's about a bouncer, kind of a zen bouncer that Patrick Swayze plays, and he has three ground rules for running his bar. One is that you never underestimate your opponent, you always take it outside, and you always make sure you're nice. And although it may seem odd to you, these are the three rules that I always keep very close to my mind and make sure that I have very, very close to, you know, I'm very, very aware of as I'm working my service job in the New York Public Library. This may seem funny to you because you've never worked in the New York Public Library, so you don't realize exactly how peculiar things can become there. And I've been thinking for some time, I guess because I've been there for a while and because, you know, you get older and you think about what you're doing, that what it is that, you know, why I work there and why I've continued to work there, why I started to work there. I started to work there for the same reason most people start to work in libraries, because I kind of, I was looking for a job, the library was hiring, and I thought, well, I'll do this for a while, and then I kept on doing it, and although it has not been a career for me, it has certainly been a living, and really, you know, for me, it has turned out to be a life, and, you know, not a bad one either, not a bad way to have spent my life. It's been a vacation for the rest of my life, but also it's been, you know, an interesting way to spend my time in ways that, in some ways, I saw coming when I started, and in other ways that I would never have been able to foresee before I started doing it, and one of the ongoing questions that happens in library work in general, perhaps because so many people seem to come into it by accident, that there is in general a feeling on the part of many people who do it that they feel embarrassed and ashamed of it in some way because people give them a hard time about it. To me, I see this as one of the great advantages of the librarian's job, that people look down their nose at you and that they don't respect you. Many people might see this as a problem. I mean, they don't realize that this is actually a big advantage. When people don't care about what you do, I mean, you're really left to, you know, you're given a lot of freedom, you know. If people don't think that what you do is worth paying attention to, then you're free to do quite a lot of things. And that's exactly what it has turned out to be for me over time. Although that aspect of things obviously is not for everybody, it certainly has turned out to be the case for a lot of interesting people that have worked there over the years, certainly people that have worked with me. And one of the things I think that sort of attracted to me to library work when I started doing it was sort of this sort of general idea that I had, you know, as I'm sure many of you have, the idea of right livelihood, you know, the idea that I just didn't want to sell anything. I didn't want to do something that was going to involve pretending to people that, you know, what I was trying to sell to them was more valuable than it actually was, that it was going to do things it wasn't really going to do. I didn't want to deceive people. I wanted to do something that would actually be helpful to them. And I also wanted something that, as I said, was going to allow me a hole to hide in so that, you know, people wouldn't see what I did as being really important. And as I said, all these things library work has turned out to be. Although it turns out that it has, like, the kind of the hidden problem in my plan is that library work has turned out to involve a lot more important things than I kind of thought that it would when I started doing it. You know, you end up being doing a lot, involving yourself in a lot more kind of crucial life problems for people than perhaps you were thinking when you got involved in it, certainly than you would if you spent your time reading things like Library Journal and American Libraries. And people who move to New York from other places, typically from Canada, and get jobs in New York, I think are kind of startled by the extent to which their library training doesn't really train them, you know, to do anything about dealing with the more human level of problems that forms the bulk of your work here. One of the things that sort of stuck in my mind recently, we've gone through a big change in the library. You know, every so often there's some big convulsive change, and one of them is that they've, after a number of years, changed the catalog that we use. And of course, everything in the library revolves around the catalog. If you don't know where things are, you know, what are you doing? Since we are, to a large extent, you know, file clerks more than anything else. Well, Jeopardy contestants and file clerks combined, I suppose. So to work to change to a new operating system and a new computerized catalog is irritating and traumatic and problematic for all of us. So doing that, of course, makes you stand back and, like, think about what you did before and what worked and what didn't and what you liked about it and what you didn't, you know, compared to what you're doing now. And I suppose that's one of the reasons that I'm kind of thinking about it at the moment. But one of the things that draws people to it, as I said, is the helping aspect of the profession, you know, that it evolved, you know, the people who were drawn to this on a professional level. Or a paraprofessional levels, I would, since I probably mentioned before, I didn't actually go to library school or anything. As I said, this is one reason why it's not a career for me. It's been a living and a life, but not a career, because I was I have an undergraduate degree in philosophy, but I never went to grad school and I never got a library degree. So I've been sort of like paraprofessionaling my way through it for all these, you know, for 25, 26 years, whatever it is that I've been working here. That, people feel that they're going to be able to use a skill that they have in order to, you know, to help people, you know, get more involved in literature, get involved, more involved in reading. They're going to, you know, advise people about books and help them write papers and all those kinds of stuff. And I guess to a certain extent you do that, but it's really, it's amazing how limited that that aspect of what you do is. Mostly, you do that. You do help people with books and reading and give advice. But mostly you just, a lot of what you do is just help people deal with the ins and outs of the stupid crud that the library places in the way of people getting to the books and the reading and the literature. You help people, like, figure out how to use the catalog. Now that we have computers in the library, you spend a lot of time helping people with their typing problems, and they're trying to figure out how to format their resume in Word and all this kind of stuff, which is, of course, beyond boring and not something that interests me in any way, and usually doesn't interest the person that I'm helping to do it either. I mean, that's the worst part of it, but that's what they come in to do, and that's what, you figure out how to help people to do. But in the back of my mind, there's like a few kind of models of, I guess, human behavior that have always, I guess, been in the back of my mind in terms of figuring out what I wanted to do. And one of them, I suppose, is that you have this idea of what it is to sort of do good, you know, because, you know, on the whole, I took up this line of work because I wanted to do good rather than do bad. As I said, you know, if I wanted to make money, I guess I could have done a lot of other things that would have involved making money. But on some level, I felt that we're here, at least, if I wasn't doing good all the time, at least I wasn't doing bad. But certainly I felt that I was sort of helping people. And when you actually get out and do this on an everyday, day in, day out, like you sign in the morning, sign out at night, kind of doing good, you begin to realize how kind of absurd that whole concept is, how it's just sort of a difficult, it's a difficult, troubled sort of concept in the first place. If you think, as I generally do, as most people went to Catholic school, about what Jesus would do in this situation, if you think of what Jesus is for, you know, the big model for what that Jesus puts forward of doing good in the world, you know, and the Gospel of St. Luke, that he talks to the, you know, remember our famous rich guy that comes up and asks him what someone's supposed to do, and he tells him that, you know, it's harder to for a rich man to get into heaven than it is for a camel to go, you know, through the eye of a needle, and he gets all bummed out and walks away. And then somebody else asks him, you know, what is it that the prophets and tell us that we're supposed to do? And he says, you're supposed to love God with all your heart, all, you know, all your soul and all your might, and you love your neighbor as yourself. And so the disciples and the people around him scratch their heads and say, well, what is it, when you say that, what is it that you have in mind? And the specific example he gives is the Good Samaritan, the parable of the Good Samaritan, which everybody knows very well. You know, that the Good Samaritan's like, you know, running on down the road, and he finds a guy who's been beat up by robbers, picks him up, takes him to an inn, pays his bill, says, like, leave some money, you know, to make sure that he's taken care of, and says, make sure that, you know, everything's taken care of, and I'm out of here. And the thing that's sort of striking to people at the time was that it's someone who's not in his own specific family group or his tribe or anything. But what I focus on at this point is that basically, you know, the Good Samaritan is like the Lone Ranger. You know, he just sort of picks up the guy, does a good deed, and he's out of there. Or the people in Route 66 or whatever, you know, he doesn't do a good deed and then have to deal with the guy the next day. And it almost seems comic to me that the whole good deed idea is put forward in this way, because it's sort of being there the next day that sort of ends up being the problem. At least I could say, after, you know, my years of experience in, you know, working in a service position in a large urban area, there's just something very egotistical about even thinking that you can help somebody in a way. I mean, you have to, like, and it sounds funny because in a way, of course, you have to leave your ego out of things in order to do a job where no one's going to really say thank you, and where you aren't celebrated, and you're not going to win an award, and where no one really knows you did it. But on the other hand, you also have to believe firmly that you know what should be done, and that you know how this person can be helped, and that you were the person to do it. And that's not a bad thing, you know, to do that. It's not a bad thing to have the ego idea that you should do this, but it's a problem. And one of the problems that ends up coming from it is that people aren't grateful. And it's stupid to think that, you know, people should be, you know, grateful since you were, you know, helping them, especially if, as in my case, you were actually paid to be there and help them. You know, why should they be grateful? I mean, I was paid to be there, whether they, you know, got helped or not. But still, there's a certain part of in the back of your mind that you're, you know, you're pissed. You know, you're pissed that people, like, you know, get help and aren't grateful. And see, this is a problem, the Good Samaritan, and people who take the Good Samaritan route, you know, the people who do random acts of kindness and senseless beauty or whatever the bumper sticker thing is. You don't deal with that. If you just do the random act of kindness and senseless beauty and just, like, take out on the road, then, of course, you don't have to deal with the consequences of the next day. And doing a good deed and having to deal with someone's gratitude or lack of it, on an everyday basis is really, that's all, like, as I didn't really quite understand when I was younger, and I could tell you now I do understand better, that's really, that's a learning experience in itself. And it's a difficult task to learn to do something and stand back and just, you know, wait for whatever the consequences are to be the consequences. I think that's the thing that has been the hardest thing for me to learn, and maybe the hardest thing for me to accept about working in my job. That you always sort of hope that if you do something, like, I mean, when the Good Samaritan rides away, he believes that, you know, that guy's in the inn and he's going to get better and he left money and, you know, everything's going to turn out okay. But in fact, he really doesn't know. He doesn't set up any kind of, you know, committee to oversee whether the innkeeper does anything for this poor guy that was hit by the robbers. He doesn't set up some kind of, like, neighborhood watch committee to make sure that they have fewer robbers on the road. He doesn't set up a kind of, you know, support committee for victims of robbers to get together and talk about what their problems are and, you know, what they want to have happen. I mean, none of this is there. And, of course, this is what we all think that, you know, you should do in the face of a social problem. When I say we, I mean, I'm being funny about it, but yes, I mean, I think this too. I don't think that just like riding in, doing a good deed and running away is kind of the way to go. And yet, isn't it more satisfying? Wouldn't it be just more satisfying to go in, do a good deed and go away and never have to deal with the, you know, the recipient of the good deed again? And kind of like, you know, the last, whatever is the Make-A-Wish Society, you know, you give the kid their trip to Disneyland. You know, let's hope it really was their dream come true. But anyway, even if it wasn't, you know, the kid's not going to be around to tell you they didn't like it, are they? You know, and or people doing good deeds for animals, you know. You hope that the dog or the cat or whatever it is that you took a stand for, you know, for animals is really going to be excited about what you did. But if they didn't, they're not going to tell you, are they? Some people that are going to tell you are the listeners to WBAI here in New York at 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored radio. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and I am your helpfully unhelpful host, Henry Hendrickson. Let me read a little bit to you from a book. It's a favorite of mine by a former librarian named Elizabeth McCracken. She's a very good writer. And she, this is from a book she wrote called The Giant's House. I believe it was her first published novel. She also wrote a collection of stories called Here's Your Hat, What's Your Hurry? Great title. And a wonderful, wonderful book called Niagara Falls All Over Again, which is kind of sort of about Abbott and Costello. But it really, it's about... it is about Abbott and Costello without really being about Abbott and Costello. And because of that, it's also about the difficulties of having working relationships with other people. But The Giant's House, in many ways, is sort of about the problem of doing good and doing bad to people that I've been talking about for the past 15 or so minutes. Librarian, like stewardess, certified public accountant, used car salesman, is one of those occupations that people assume attract a certain deformed personality. Librarians are supposed to be bitter spinsters, grudging, lonely, and above all stingy. We love our fine money, and we love our silence. I did not love the fine money. I forgave much more than I collected. I did not shush people unless they yelled. And though I was technically a spinster, I was bitter only insofar as people made me. It isn't that bitter people become librarians. It's that being a librarian may turn the most giving person bitter. We're paid all day to be generous, and no one recognizes our generosity. As a librarian, I longed to be acknowledged, even to be taken for granted. I sat at the desk, brimming with book reviews, information, warnings, all my good schooling advanced. I wanted people to constantly, callously approach. But there were days when nobody talked to me at all. They just walked to the shelves and grabbed a book and checked out, said at most, "Thank you," and sometimes only, "You're welcome," when I thanked them first. I had gone to school to learn how to help them, but they believed that I was simply a clerk who stamped the books. All it takes is a patron asking, and then asking again. A piece of paper covered with notes, the pencil smudged a left-hander, for instance, James, will smudge more. The patron you become fond of will say, "I can't believe you have this book," or even better, believe it or not, "You don't own this book. Is there a way that I can get it?" Oh, yes. It's true. I mean, you spend a lot of your day. It's funny how much that, you know, the knowledge you have of books. I mean, people who know a lot about books, when they come into a library, they never ask the librarian for help. So, I mean, I know all kinds of things about, you know, the history of the... about the history of publishing generally, or the history of, like, how, you know, Shakespeare's plays, or history of, you know, the rather weird and interesting, you know, publication history of Women's Leaves of Grass, for example. It says something like, what is it, 73, 83 states without, you know, with only a single one edition until the turn of the century. That questions like this never, ever, ever, ever come up in your professional life, unless maybe I bet even for the people who have the work in telephone reference, it never comes up. It never comes up if you work in an archival or rare book and manuscript collection, because in there, the people who come in know are world authorities in their field, and they never need any help from you. And if you work in a sort of a small, as I can tell you, because I worked for 6 years in one, and, you know, although it was amazing to work in there and get to work with that material, I mean, you don't ever answer information questions for people, really. It has other interesting things about it, but, you know, you don't help people in that sense. And if you work in a neighborhood reading branch, you have a very tremendously wide variety of people come in with a very wide variety of questions. But as I said, they don't really ask you many questions about the things that librarians are likely to know about, given their background. I mean, you know, librarians tend to be English majors and such, and to know, as I said, a lot about the history of, you know, whatever literary period they're interested in, their history of literature generally, probably they usually know a lot about the history of the book, because it's bookish people that, you know, people who not just like to read but are interested in, like, books as books tend to become librarians. And nobody ever asks you about stuff like that, I guess, unless you work in some kind of, like, center of the book or something. But the people who know about books, and they don't ask you anything. The people that you get a lot of questions about from people who know very little about books, and they come in for different reasons. And even after all these years, that's a part of me that's a little surprised by it. But there's a logic to that, and it's a logic that I understand. The thing that is actually a little harder to understand is, but I think it has to do with the nature of service jobs in general. An interesting book that came out a couple of years ago is a book, well, I'm not going to give the actual title. It's Another BS Night in Suck City. That's not the actual title. Then the real title of the book, it's not the acronym that I've given. A guy named Nick Flynn, who is a poet and also someone who worked as a CSW and an intake counselor in a homeless shelter. And he had the startling and really unenviable, you know, experience of finding that one of the people that he was letting into his shelter on a pretty regular basis was his own estranged father, who had become, you know, a pretty hopeless alcoholic, had been, you know, separated from the family for a long time, and, you know, had just gotten to the point where he wasn't really dealing with other people in any, to a large extent, in any really meaningful way. And so, you know, they knew each other, but yet they weren't really kind of acknowledging each other, other than in a very minimal kind of way. And this went on for years, that he just, you know, every, you know, few days or, you know, periods of weeks that he would go in and he would let his own, he would, like, you know, sign his own dad into the homeless shelter as an intake counselor. And that's the kind of thing that I think ends up being, that's really extreme. I mean, I can't say I've ever had to deal with anything that upsetting, but what ends up happening from working in a place like a public library, where you have a public space where people, it's one of the few places where people are really allowed to come, especially in New York where everything costs money, who maybe don't have a lot of other places to go. You end up dealing with the same people over and over and over again, and you see them over and over and over again over a period of years, and you don't, you know, there's, you hope that things are changing for them, and you hope that after a certain period of time you're just not going to see them anymore, and you hope if you don't see them that it's for a good reason and not for a bad reason, but you don't really know. And there are limits on... Well, I was going to say there are limits on what you can really do for somebody. Perhaps there aren't. Perhaps there... It's just limits that I, because of my other experiences with working with people in the library, have put on myself for working in there. I mean, a famous story about Barack Obama, for example, is that he was being interviewed by somebody, while he was still, they were still putting his name forward as somebody who was going to be, like, the representative from Illinois, whatever, to the state senate in Illinois. And some homeless guy came up to the table where he was being interviewed and asked him for money. And he said, "Well, my good man, is that all that you can think of for yourself? Wouldn't you like a better life than that?" And he pulls out a whole bunch of, like, referral numbers for the guy to go and, like, get a job and get more education and get some clothes to go for interviews and blah, 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 blah. And, really, that's why he's a president and I'm not, because I would never sort of presume to do that for someone who just came up and asked for money. I guess because I feel that the courtesy that I show people is that, I don't start assuming that they want more than what they asked me for, which perhaps is, I acknowledge it's perhaps a limitation on my part, but I just feel it's a way of showing kindness and courtesy to people who, when somebody seems to me is, like, in a bad way, just dealing with them the way I deal with anybody else that comes in seems to me the most polite and kind way of dealing with that person. And sometimes it can be kind of difficult because they clearly aren't, dealing with life or having the same experience of life or having going home to the same things that other people are. But it still seems that the library can be one place where they're treated like other people are, and they just sit down and, read the paper like anybody else. But on the other hand, maybe they want more. And there's only so much that we can give them. And this brings me to the final thing that is perhaps the most difficult thing about what I do, which is that I made a joke about gratefulness and ungratefulness, but just there are so many people that I deal with, and it's probably true, I think, in any large urban library. They're just angry. I deal with so many incredibly angry, unhappy people all the time. And often they're the ones that I deal with the most because I guess, and some, for whatever reason, life just went wrong for them at some point. And they're just stuck coming into the library all the time. And while we can give them a place to sit and you can read current newspapers and read books and go on the computer and, we have a bathroom and a drinking fountain, some other things, there are worse ways to spend your day. On the other hand, it doesn't really provide much of a life if that's, if you wanted more than that, which, most people did. It's like it's a haven, but on the other hand, I think it begins to feel like a trap to people. And it's amazing how you will end up getting with these incredibly angry conversations with people that you never saw coming. And it's because they're just angry. And nothing we can give them can really, they need so much more than we could possibly give them. And it's just depressing because, as I said, this is not a Good Samaritan thing of, like, riding along, dropping a sack of cash and riding away. This is a day-in, day-out thing, kind of like, Nick Flynn signing his dad to the homeless shelter. There's so much more that his dad needed than just a bed to rest in the homeless shelter. He probably needed a relationship, with his son, one would think, just as his son needed a relationship with the father. And yet things had just deteriorated to a point where that's what the son had available to give him. And in a way, that's all the father felt comfortable in asking. And yet, I'm sure there was more, going on than that. And and to much more so than anything having to do with like advising people about books or, you know, I mean, the fun stuff is helping people pick up books or helping, you know, a kid comes up with a, you know, a book list and you help them get all the picture books on their list or, you know, they're really, really excited about, you know, they've just discovered Roald Dahl, you know, or something like that. Typical, that's a typical one. And they're so worked up because you have a bunch of the books on the shelf and they, you know, they're really, really, really happy about it. And, you know, you love doing stuff like that. Or someone who doesn't know how to use a computer and they come in and they just by being able to practice on it, they figure it out. And it's very satisfying, you know, to talk to someone who, you know, has several people that, you know, I have worked with over the years, you know, have been able to actually in a couple of places, in a couple, you know, cases, they've actually started their own business, you know. From being able to, you know, from starting out, just like learning that, you know, people, you know, me and other people at the library showing them how to use a mouse and go up and down on a screen, you know, they were able to get somewhere from that. But then, of course, they had somewhere to go. But it's just difficult to see people who need a lot and to not have anything to give them. In a way, it would be easier if I really, literally had nothing to give them. To have them, like, to give them a little something that kind of gets into the day. I have come to realize there's a certain level on which it's even worse. I don't know what to say other than that. I'm just, I guess I'm sort of thinking over some things I've seen in the last few days. It's just an ugly thing to see people fighting with each other over, you know, who gets to read the newspaper first or someone who comes in and, you know, someone who is a kind of person as, the kind of person I have described, you know, who is, you know, life hasn't, you know, gone well for them. And, you know, they're living in some kind of SRO. I mean, they're not homeless. They have a home, but it's not a very homey home. You know, there's like a place to stay and maybe a place to keep their stuff. And that's about it. And that's why they're, you know, finding other places to be during the day. And to have them, you know, you can see why they're trying to sort of like stake out a claim. You know, they'll come and they'll like take every single newspaper and then sit there reading Harper's on top of it. And when people come over and start, you know, like asking them about it, they deliberately pick a fight because then that's just something to do. And I guess that what we provide in some way is a place for people, you know, to do something. Maybe that's an experience. If nothing else, at least that's an experience that someone is having in the course of the day. And it's sad that it has to be a negative experience, but I guess that's an experience in its own way. There's a writer named Nicole Krauss who wrote a book of the history of love a couple of years ago. And the main character in it, well, we've discovered many things about him in the course of the book. But he's an older guy, and he is at a point in his life where he just is obsessed with the idea that every single day when he goes out, he wants to make sure that he is noticed by people. He just, the idea that he could just go through the day and no one, he would never have human contact and that people wouldn't remember him, that they wouldn't talk to him, that just, that's just intolerable to him increasingly. He just can't handle the idea. So he goes out and deliberately makes sure that he's remembered. And it's almost always a negative thing. Like he goes to Duane Reade and he knocks down, you know, a whole display of aspirin or you know, something like that. He always does something so that, like, people will turn around and they'll be angry and they'll be yelling and there'll be, like, a big thing. And he'll be standing there apologizing, even though he did it on purpose. Because even that is better than having people not interact with him. And a number of the people that are, as I said, the regular people, the people that are there day in, day out, the people that are waiting to the door when I unlock it in the morning and the people that I have to kind of like shush out at night, those are the people. Those are the people that I'm dealing with. Now, these are not the only people that I'm dealing with, and I guess I've sort of been focusing on it because I had a couple of very, like, kind of ugly. For some reason this week, I just had, in the last, you know, couple of days, and the week before, I had a couple of, like, really, really ugly fights between a number of people that would all fall into this category of, like, the regulars who, you know, I like to think that they have something going on outside of the library, but, you know, the way they act doesn't make me feel that they do. And trying to mediate between these folks and having them get so angry at me, you know, was enough to make me sort of like pull back and sort of start thinking about, you know, the value or lack of value, perhaps, about what I do. And I mean, oddly enough, I still really wouldn't, you know, I am interested in what I do. I am still interested in talking to people. I'm always interested in finding out, you know, why people come in and what they want to find out and what they do. And it's just, there's a part of me that still can't really quite accept how little we're really doing. You know, I mean, I know it's like, it's a big societal problem, and we just have this, like, small... We have this small place in the library where we provide, you know, maybe it is a place to sit down and collect your thoughts. But it's so easy, I think, to pull away and just focus on, like, the specifics of, like, oh my gosh, we're totally out of Agatha Christie. I have to get through this book list. I have to reorder this and that and the other thing. I have to, like, you know, I'm doing schedules. You know, we have to figure out how we're possibly going to cover all the hours in the day, and, you know. And then you just come brought up short by, you know, by someone's unhappiness and your inability to really do much to help them. And it just made me sad, which is, I guess, why I decided that I needed to talk about this tonight. I don't have any answer for it. I mean, in some level, that stuff doesn't really get better. As long as we live in the New York that has been developing over the past, you know, a few decades, where every successive administration has been trying to make it difficult for people to live here without money, you know, it doesn't get easier, you know, for people who have problems. And a lot of people who have, you know, if you have problems, it's certainly made it, it's not, you know, not having any money just makes it worse. And a lot of times, if you had money, you could even have, like, problems getting along with other people, and it wouldn't even be a problem, because you just have, you know, access to your own apartment. You could just stay in there, and you could be as pissy and crabby as you wanted, because you'd have your place, and you'd just be in there. But once you don't have the money, then, of course, you know, all these other things, you know, they don't help you. You have to have a very specific kind of, like, outgoing, winning personality in order to be poor. It's not easy to be poor. And I think the older you get, probably the harder it is for folks. Well, that isn't really where I was planning to go with all this, but it's clearly where I ended up. And I think I'm just gonna go out with another library book related song, and leave it out for Tom Whisker, who I know is here and raring to go. And my name is Henry Henderson. This has been the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and let's go out with Bo Diddley. Although, you know what? In my experience, you often can judge a book by its cover. But let's let him give his take on it. Let's give him put his argument forward.
Can't judge an apple by looking at a tree. You can't judge honey by looking at the bee. You can't judge.
daughter by looking at the mother. You can't judge a book by looking at the cover. Oh, can't you see? Oh, you misjudged me. I look like a farmer, but I'm a lover. Can't judge a book by looking at the cover. I gotta say, you got your radio turned down too low. Turn it up. Ow. You can't judge sugar by looking at the cane. You can't judge a woman by looking at her man. You can't judge a sister by looking at her brother. You can't judge a book by looking at the cover. Oh, can't you see? Oh, you misjudged me. Well, I look like a farmer, but I'm a lover. Can't judge a book by looking at the cover. Come on.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.